Everybody, this is Jeff, otherwise known as Brendan Beefish. Back again for part two. If you'll recall from last week, I released part one of this essay series in an audio format. Part one was released on back in October 2014, and then part two is actually coming out today. So it's going to coincide with this audio recording. So if you're listening over iTunes or over Podbean or another one of those formats, it'll actually coincide with the essay itself. So if you'd like to read the essay, you're welcome to visit my blog, which is brendanbeefish.wordpress.com, and where you can read it there. Otherwise, sit back, enjoy, and this is the Wars and Politics of Ice and Fire podcast. So welcome back again. Today's podcast is entitled The Dragon's Mercy, The Violent Future Path of Daenerys Targaryen, Part 2, Reborn on the Dothraki Sea. Now some of you guys might be wondering whether I actually like Daenerys as a character, or maybe even wondering why I spent so much time writing about her. Well, to answer the first question, it's a qualified yes. I like Daenerys Targaryen, and I like her character. I enjoy reading about the struggles that she had when she came up as a young girl of 13 in A Game of Thrones, and to see her character evolve throughout the story has been interesting to me. That being said, Dany probably isn't in my top five characters. But I recognize that George R. R. Martin has put a lot of emphasis on Daenerys Targaryen, and I think it's important to examine her because she has so many contours in her personality as well as in her character development. And I also think it's really interesting to kind of figure out where George R. R. Martin is planning on taking Daenerys Targaryen in the future. So, hence the essay series. So, let's get this started. First and foremost, I want to take a moment to thank you all for listening to this podcast. This is the second episode of this podcast, and I'm incredibly grateful that you guys are all listening to it. So, thank you very much for listening to this, and thank you very much for reading my blog and supporting it for over a year now. And now here's your spoiler warning. Part 2 of The Dragon's Mercy, The Violent Future Path of Daenerys Targaryen, picks up where we last left Dany, at the end of A Dance with Dragons. Originally, I intended this to be a two-part recording, but I estimated that the writing for Part 2 would probably be a little bit too much to record in one setting. So, in lieu of a very long read of mine, I've decided to make this into three parts. While much of these two parts will be speculative and based on clues and foreshadowing from the first five books of Song of Ice and Fire, I will need to delve into some of the Winds of Winter sample material and interviews that George R. R. Martin gave about the Winds of Winter. As such, this essay and recording contain both major and minor spoilers for the Winds of Winter. Alright, let's get started. Early in A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys abandons her violent Mother of Dragons persona and embraces a peaceful conception of motherhood known as the Mysa. But within the space of one chapter of this embrace, Dany is confronted with a scene of such personal violence that it challenges her newfound peaceful desires. In A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 2, reports reach Dany that 9 Unsullied soldiers have been killed by the Sons of the Harpy outside of a wine shop. Missandor, the brother of Missandei, is among those dead from the ambush. The murder of the Unsullied shocks Dany, but equally upsetting is that the perpetrators escaped custody. Instead, the Unsullied took the owner of the wine shop where the attack occurred into custody for questioning. Likely to ensure thoroughness in their investigation, the Unsullied also take the wine cellar's daughters into custody as well. Quote, Missandor. Dany made a fist. Missandei and her brothers had been taken from their home on Nath by the raiders from the Bastlyk Isles, and had been sold into slavery in Astapor. Young as she was, Missandei had shown such a gift for tongues that the good masters had made a scribe of her. Missandor and Marcellin had not been so fortunate. They had been gelded, and made into Unsullied. Have any of the murderers been captured? Your servants have arrested the owner of the wine shop and his daughters. They plead their ignorance and beg for mercy. Unquote. With witnesses appealing to the Mysa, Dany is left in a bit of a quandary. She suspects the wine cellar of some sort of complicity in the act, or at least knowing more than he's let on. But what could she do to retrieve that information? Simply questioning the wine cellar or his daughters might not net the results needed to identify the perpetrators, but torturing the wine cellar might extract the information. It might be morally nebulous, or even wrong, but it could lead to a more peaceful Meereen in the long term. Dany, for her part, is skeptical of the wine cellar's declaration of innocence, but at the same time, she's unwilling to take on the Mother of Dragons' mantle. Quote, They all plead for ignorance and beg for mercy. give them to the shave pate. Skahas, keep each apart from the others and put them to the question. It will be done, your worship. Would you have me question them sweetly or sharply? Sweetly to begin, hear what tales they tell and what names they give you, and maybe that they had no part in this. Unquote. Danny's statement gives the impression that while the death of the Unsullied and Missandor angers her, their deaths as soldiers as Unsullied made some sort of cosmic sense. Like the Joker put it in A Dark Knight, quote, if tomorrow I tell the press that like a gangbanger will get shot or a truckload of soldiers will be blown up, nobody panics. Unquote. Though the news is bad, it's not bad enough to push Dany towards conflict between her two conceptions of motherhood. So by ordering an ethical interrogation of the wine cellar and his daughters, Dany shows that her Mother of Dragons instinct is tempered by her sense of cosmic justice. But when Skahas Mokandak reports on the other murders, ones that don't make any cosmic sense, Dany is utterly dumbfounded. Quote, she hesitated. Nine, the noble Resnick said. Who else? Three freedmen, murdered in their homes, the Shadepate said. A moneylender, a cobbler, and the harpist Rylona Ree. They cut her fingers off before they killed her. The queen flinched. Rylona Ree had played the harp as sweetly as the maiden. When she had been a slave in Yunkai, she had played for every highborn family in the city. In Meereen, she had become the leader amongst the Yunkish freedmen, their voice in Dany's councils. We have no captives but this wine cellar? None, this one grieves to confess. We beg your pardon. When Dany flinches, it's a tell on George R. R. Martin's part that he's about to turn the tables on the reader. Just prior to this moment, we're lured into feeling that Dany will do the right thing, that she will hold firm in her Mysa identity. But when Dany flinches, it's demonstrating that her moral firmness in the matter is a bit less solid than thought. The deaths of the Unsullied were tragic and horrific, but they could be processed mentally, because soldiers dying, while tragic, is more cosmically understandable than innocents dying. But when innocents die unnecessarily, or when they are murdered, Dany's Mysa side gives way to the Mother of Dragons. When innocent slave children were cruelly crucified against the milepost of Meereen, Dany let her vengeful Mother of Dragons persona rage. The Mother of Dragons exacted her vengeance in the form of crucifying 163 Meereenese great masters without determining their guilt or innocence and the deaths of innocents. Here, when confronted with a very personal loss, one that defies any cosmic sense, Dany once again turns to the Mother of Dragons. Quote, mercy, thought Dany. They will have the dragon's mercy. Skahas, I have changed my mind. Question the man sharply. I could, or I could question the daughter sharply while the father looks on. That will wring some names from him. Do as you think best, but bring me names. Her fury was a fire in her belly. So the dragon's mercy can be broadly defined as Daenerys fulfilling her emotional need to visit vengeance upon those who have harmed innocents. But before you agree that this is good or even admirable, the dragon's mercy has parameters that go beyond the mere protection of innocents. Torturing the wine cellar could perhaps be justified in a moral sense, but torturing his daughters while the father looks on? That's a little less justifiable, to say the least. It's these moral and pragmatic shortcuts to achieve her ends and fulfill a personal emotional need that define the dragon's mercy. But it's these shortcuts that have villainous overtones. Do heroes allow innocents to be tortured? It's a question that Martin at least wants us to ask. So when at the end of A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys re-embraces her Mother of Dragons identity, she's also inherently embracing a mindset of the dragon's mercy, too. Worse, she's wrapping her avenging dragon persona in a prophetic vision of destiny. Gone are the days when Dany made peace with her enemies. Gone still further is the willingness to make compromises to safeguard innocence. Instead, in The Winds of Winter, we'll find that Daenerys Targaryen will bring the dragon's mercy to Essos. Meereenese, Yunkish, Valentine, and Pentashi will feel the heat of the dragon's mercy as Daenerys Targaryen burns her way across Essos. But first, she'll bring fire and blood to the Dothraki. When we last left Daenerys, she had made her final break from her Mysa identity and embraced a fire and blood mentality wrapped in a prophetic vision of destiny. But Dany's last chapter in A Dance with Dragons doesn't end there. Instead, George R. R. Martin pushes the narrative forward just a little further. After a conversation with the Swaying Grass, Dany emerges from her vision quest to the reality around her. Stuck in the Dothraki Sea with only the occasional presence of Drogon to keep her company, Dany's immediate future is uncertain. But then a Dothraki scout emerges out of the tall grass in front of her. Hidden by the tall grass, Dany's presence goes unnoticed, but when the scout departs, Daenerys begins shouting after the rider. This causes Drogon to fly to Dany's presence. After tellingly echoing Quaithe's, to go forward you must go back prophecy, she mounts Drogon to chase after the Dothraki scout. While on intercept course, Drogon and Dany fly over a herd of horses with about 20 Dothraki riders among them. Drogon and Dany then descend down on an unmounted horse. There, In a highly symbolic measure, Drogon lights the horse on fire, and then he and Dany eat the horse. The chapter concludes with Khal Jako and 50 warriors from his Khalasar finding Dany and Drogon. Quote, "That was how Khal Jako found her, when 50 mounted knights emerged from the drifting smoke." So before we move into what I suspect will immediately transpire after Khal Jako's discovery of Daenerys, who is this Khal Jako fellow? Is this someone that we've met previously? Yeah, it sure is. Khal Jako was a Kho, that is, a subordinate commander or lieutenant of Khal Drogo's. When Khal Drogo fell from his horse and appeared all but dead, Khal Jako took on the mantle of Khal and claimed 20,000 of Drogo's riders. Quote, "The Dothraki follow only the strong," Ser Jorah had said. "I am sorry, my princess. There is no way to hold them. Khal Pono left first, naming himself Khal Pono, and many followed him. Jako was not long to do the same." Unquote. Among Khal Jako's new blood riders is a nasty horseman by the name of Mago. Mago is another Dothraki that is first introduced to the reader during the Dothraki attack of the Lazarene. In that chapter, Daenerys saves a few of the Lazarene people from being claimed by the Dothraki. Among some of those claimed were captives of a blood rider known as Mago. Dany's action infuriates Mago. Specifically, one of the captives that Dany claims is a slave girl named Aerio, and this slave girl was someone that Mago hoped to rape. Quote, "This one is Mago, who rides in the cause of Khal Jako. He says the Khaleesi has taken his spoils, a daughter of the lambs who was his to mount." Unquote. Mago attempted to take Aerio back, but his attempt was thwarted by Drogo. But when Khal Drogo and Dany fell into comas, Mago seized on the opportunity. Quote, "They took Khal Drogo's herds, Khaleesi," Ricaro said. "We were too few to stop them. It is the right of the strong to take from the weak. They took many slaves as well, the Khals and yours. Yet they left some few." "Aerio?" asked Dany, remembering the frightened child she had saved outside of the city of the Landmen. "Mago seized her, who was Khal Jako's blood rider now," said Jogo. "He mounted her high and low and gave her to his Khal, and Jako gave her to his other blood riders. They were six. When they were done with her, they cut her throat." Unquote. Now, the gang rape and murder of Aerio enrages Dany at that time. Though powerless at the end of a Game of Thrones, Daenerys swears bloody vengeance on Jako and Mago. Quote, "Khaleesi," the handmaid Eerie explained as if to a child. "Jako is Khal now, with 20,000 riders at his back." She lifted her head. "And I am Daenerys Stormborn, Daenerys of House Targaryen, of the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, and Maegar the Cruel, and old Valyria before them. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you, these men will die screaming." Unquote. After Game of Thrones, Mago and Jako drop from the main narrative, but their names and exploits remain in Dany's mind. After Daenerys embraces her mice identity at the end of A Storm of Swords, she later reflects on Aerio, but tellingly, rather than thinking of the vengeance she will exact for her gang rape and murder, she regards Aerio as an example of her failure to safeguard innocent life. Quote, "It is Aerio all over again." Brown Ben Plum was puzzled. "Who is Aerio?" "A girl I thought I saved from rape and torment. All I did was make it worse for her in the end, and all I did in Astapor was to make 10,000 Aerios." Unquote. And in Dany's last chapter in A Dance with Dragons, she actually thinks about Mago and Jako again. As she wanders across the Dothraki Sea, she reflects back to Mago and Jako. Tellingly, this occurs just before Dany has her dramatic vision of destiny and her encounter with the Dothraki. Quote, "Khal Jako named himself Khal Jako and rode off with even more. Mago, his blood rider, raped and murdered Aerio, a girl Dany had once tried to save from him. Only the birth of her dragons amidst the fire and smoke of Khal Drogo's funeral pyre had spared Dany herself from being dragged back to Vaes Dothrak to live out the remainder of her days amongst the crones of the Dosh Kaleen." Unquote. As such, Dany's memory of Jako and Mago is very fresh when she has a prophetic reckoning with fire and blood. It's not coincidental after Dany's vision that she then encounters Khal Jako's Khalasar again. And that's how Dany's last chapter ends. Now, moving past A Dance with Dragons territory into speculation territory, it's important to note something very symbolic at the end of Dany's last chapter in A Dance with Dragons. Right at the very end of the chapter, Drogon and Dany descend on an unmounted horse where Drogon proceeds to light the horse on fire and then eats the horse meat with Dany. Now, George R. Martin sometimes likes to hit his readers over the head with sigil and animal symbolism. Think, for instance, the direwolf skewered by the stag in A Game of Thrones, for example. Here, George is practically telegraphing what's going to occur after Dany and Drogon's fateful encounter with Khal Jako's Khalasar. First, while the 20 Dothraki scouts may have run from Daenerys and Drogon initially, they went for help and came back in force. With now 50 Dothraki confronting Dany, it's clear that they mean business and hope that greater numbers will give them a chance against Daenerys and a dragon. But will numbers actually matter? Probably not. This is how I imagine that Dany's first chapter will open in The Winds of Winter. Either in that moment or in recollection, Dany will make a play at taking Khal Jaqos Khalasar from him. And how would she accomplish this? Well, remember Jorah Mormont's estimation of the Dothraki? Quote, "The Dothraki only follow the strong," unquote. Given that Khal Jaqos seized a sizable part of Khal Drogo's Khalasar by demonstrating his strength, Dany seizing back that part or all of Jaqos Khalasar makes even more poetic sense here. And so I imagine that some sort of confrontation between Daenerys and Khal Jaqos will take place either in the Dothraki Sea or in a place we'll get to in a moment. And how well would even the best Dothraki warrior do against Dragonfire? Poorly. But if Dany and Drogon start her campaign of fire and blood by killing Khal Jaqos, what about the fate of Maego the Blood Rider? In the HBO series Game of Thrones, Maego was killed by Khal Drogo after the Lazarine battle. But we know that Maego is one of Jaqos's Blood Riders in A Song of Ice and Fire. So in a rare revelation about The Winds of Winter, George R. R. Martin said something interesting about Maego in an interview shortly after A Dance with Dragons published. Quote, "So Maego is not dead in the books, and in fact, he's going to be a recurring character in The Winds of Winter. He's a particularly nasty blood rider to one of the other Khals that has broken away after Drogo dies." Unquote. I interpret this to mean that Maego will survive the initial encounter with Daenerys, and that he will take some of Jaqos's old Khalasar with him. And given that he'll be a recurring character in The Winds of Winter, I think that Maego will play the role of an antagonist to Dany throughout her Fire and Blood campaign in Essos. But if Dany has seized part of a Khalasar, would she return to Meereen, or would she attempt something more drastic? The obvious play here would be to have Daenerys make her way back to Meereen with Drogon and a partial Khalasar. However, if we look at Dany's mental state, we know that she's rejected the Meereenese as her children, and while she may wish to return to Meereen in order to reunite with Daario, the urgency to return to Meereen is likely not as it once was. Even more so, Dany's mystical encounter with Quaithe in her final chapter and her new vision of prophetic destiny will likely push her temporarily from the Harpy City. Instead, I think that Dany's repetition of Quaithe's "to go forward, you must go back" mantra prior to mounting Drogon in her last chapter is a tell that Martin is planning to have Dany return to a place in her history, that place being Vaes Dothrak. In a brief window into The Winds of Winter, George R. R. Martin, while not confirming that he was writing about Vaes Dothrak, gave broad hints as to what he was writing in mid-2012. Quote, "Winds of Winter. Yes, I am working on that too. At the moment, I am writing about the Dothraki. More than that, I say if not. You know I don't like to talk about this stuff." Unquote. Now, Vaes Dothrak and the Dothraki people represent many things to Dany. It's where she came into her own power, and more importantly, that power was derived from a prophetic vision of destiny, at least the initial one, that is. So Vaes Dothrak provides a fitting place for Dany to return to. As Dany is taking on this new mystical mantle, Dany will likely start to re-examine some of the prophecies that were spoken to her back in A Game of Thrones. Remember the Stallion that Mounts the World prophecy that was given to Dany's unborn child? Will Dany start to believe that this prophecy wasn't meant for Rhaego, that it was meant for her? And what of Quaithe's prophecies? Will her cryptic words impact Dany's travels? Quote, "To go north, you must go south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow." Unquote. Just as kind of an aside, this prophecy by Quaithe is one that many fans interpret to mean something about Dany going back to Ashai. But while George R. R. Martin may have thought to send Daenerys to Ashai early in writing A Song of Ice and Fire, I'm fairly confident that she won't make her way back to Ashai in the last two books based on two things that Martin said in an interview. Quote, interviewer, "Will we ever see Ashai?" George R. R. Martin, "Only in flashback and memory, if at all." Unquote. So moving beyond Quaithe, there's also the issue of Dany's visions from the House of the Undying. While prophecy in A Song of Ice and Fire turns the hearer towards shortcuts and morally gray actions, the prophecies and visions that Daenerys experienced in the House of the Undying are probably the truest glimpses into the future. A prominent part of the House of the Undying vision refers to a nearby terrain feature of Vaes Dothrak. Quote, "Beneath the Mother Mountains, a line of naked crones crept from a great lake and knelt shivering before her, their gray heads bowed." Unquote. Now, this lesser-cited portion of the House of the Undying prophecy is something that kind of sticks out after a few reads. Has any of this ever been fulfilled previously? I don't see where it has, necessarily. So what does it mean? First, a few points. The Mother Mountains is the most prominent terrain feature in and around Vaes Dothrak and the endless flat grassland of the Dothraki Sea. The Mother Mountains also has spiritual significance to the Dothraki people. Now, Turning away from the mountain, the crones referenced here are a likely reference to the Dosh Kalin, that is, the widowed Khaleesi of Dead Kals. Their significance in the story was felt early, when they prophesied that Dany's child would be the stallion that would mount the world. Later, Dany's turn to Mary Mazdor to save Khal Drogo's life was at least partially motivated by her unwillingness to join the Dosh Kalin. Returning to the vision from the House of the Undying, it's important to note again that the subjects of prophecy and vision oftentimes misinterpret the visions and prophecies that they experience. So, are the line of naked crones shivering from the coldness of the lake that they just emerged from? Maybe. But the lake doesn't really have any special significance to Dany. While cold might be a reason for shivering, a more intriguing possibility is that it isn't water that's making the Dosh Kalin shiver. Rather, it's fear that is causing the crones to shiver, or more accurately, shake, with fright. A Targaryen queen mounted on a dragon demanding pledges of fealty would be a terrifying sight to behold. The vision's reference to the crones kneeling with their grey heads bowed, therefore, the vision's reference to the crones kneeling with their grey heads bowed likely references some sort of homage that the Dosh Kalin are giving to Daenerys Targaryen, likely based on fear. But outside of the thematic purpose, if Martin was writing about the Dothraki and Vaes Dothrak, what plot purpose would returning to Vaes Dothrak serve for Dany's arc? Well, first, it could serve as the confrontation point between Daenerys and Jaqo, or Daenerys and Maego. If Dany doesn't kill Jaqo or Maego on the Dothraki Sea, Vaes Dothrak would make for a dramatic confrontation. Moreover, if the final confrontation between these two Dothraki and Daenerys occurs in Vaes Dothrak, and a certain dragon is involved in the confrontation, it could serve as a callback to events from A Game of Thrones. So recall the Dothraki traditions about the shedding of blood. Quote, "The Dothraki esteem Vaes Dothrak as the holiest of cities. No blood may be shed there." But Khal Drogo found a way to circumvent this with Viserys. Recall how Viserys was killed in Vaes Dothrak and not a drop of blood was shed. It's possible that Daenerys will both uphold and subvert this time-honored Dothraki tradition and use dragonfire to kill Jaqo and Maego within Vaes Dothrak. That is, if either aren't killed out in the Dothraki Sea. Moreover, this event or any number of events could serve as a focal point to unite the Dothraki into a giant Khalasar under Daenerys. The World of Ice and Fire makes two interesting notes regarding the future of the Dothraki. The first is an admission that the Dothraki will eventually unite. Quote, "Wiser men know that it's only a matter of time until the Khalasars unite again under some great call and turn west once more in search of new conquest." And then the second reference in the World of Ice and Fire takes a look at the prophecies surrounding the Dothraki. Quote, "One day, all the Khalasars shall gather together once more beneath the banners of the great call, who will conquer all, the stallion who mounts the world." Dany's return to Vaes Dothrak would serve as the impetus for the grand unification of the Dothraki under a singular leader. The city serves as a good central location for bringing the Dothraki together under the Call of Khals, or, in the case of Daenerys, the Khaleesi of Khals. So let's take a second to talk about the thematic impulse for Dany's coming Dothraki arc. When we take a step back from the thematic and plot purposes and try to get a 10,000-foot view of why George R. R. Martin would want to take us back to the Dothraki, some interesting meta-themes emerge. Dany's return to Vaes Dothrak may make sense to drive Dany's plot and character arc forward, but there are still other issues that come into play. As a people group, the Dothraki have a less-than-stellar reputation among the peoples of Essos. The World of Ice and Fire sums up this prevailing view of the Dothraki nicely. Quote, "The Dothraki remain nomads still, a savage and wild people who prefer tents to palaces." Unquote. And though it would be unfair to castigate the Dothraki completely, their reputation for savagery is not unwarranted. No one who has read the chapters of the Dothraki sack of the Lazarine town in A Game of Thrones comes away marveling at the human rights record of the Dothraki. Instead, George R. R. Martin intends us to react with horror to the scenes of murder and rape. So, it would seem that Dothraki culture in and of itself was intentionally designed by George R. R. Martin to be foreign to us living in modernity. We can't sympathize with brutal military conquest and mass human trafficking that flows from these conquests. Moreover, even outside of their brutal military methods and tactics, the Dothraki as a people group are utterly alien to our cultural mores and customs. But interestingly, in an interview, George R. R. Martin seems to almost regret that the Dothraki seem so one-dimensional. Interviewer, "People complain that the Dothraki are this one-dimensional barbarian society." George R. R. Martin, "I haven't had a Dothraki viewpoint character, though." Unquote. But if Martin might regret the lack of a Dothraki POV character, it doesn't mean that he won't use their one-dimensional nature to manipulate readers. If Daenerys were to confront the Dothraki atop Drogon, most readers would be hard-pressed to summon much sympathy for the Dothraki. This becomes even more true when George R. R. Martin inevitably brings us the confrontation between Daenerys and Mago and Jaqo. Both men represent the pinnacle of Dothraki culture, and both represent the evils inherent in Dothraki culture. Interestingly, I think that George R. R. Martin is setting this up to be another moment similar to what occurred in Astapor in A Storm of Swords. There, Daenerys, confronted by the horrors of the slave culture in Astapor, betrayed the wise masters of Astapor and brought fire and blood to them and their ilk. And in that Dracarys moment, we as readers cheer Dany's actions. As readers, we love seeing some cosmic justice dealt to these Tokar-wearing slavers. In the case of Astapor, it's hard to really argue against Dany's actions to violently end the reign of the wise masters. Though, it should be noted that someone made the point that Dany's breach of contract was kind of egregious. But all that being said, the cost in human lives in Astapor was enough that Dany's actions were regarded as a sack afterwards. And so, any punitive or military action that Dany takes with the Dothraki will likely be cheered by fans. But given the subtext of Dany's newfound Targaryen and prophetic identities, George will likely be inviting readers to evaluate her actions against her prophetic and Mother of Dragons identities. Moreover, there's a subtle change that will likely be at work. Dany's actions in Astapor were motivated by her desire to safeguard innocence, those who became her children. When the Unsullied joined her thereafter, it was a significant windfall to her humanitarian impulse, but securing the Unsullied was not her primary motivation in letting fire and blood rain down on Astapor. But will Dany be motivated by humanitarian reasons with regard to the Dothraki? Or will her actions be motivated by a desire to secure a Khalasar and a larger army to take the throne of Westeros back from her enemies? For that matter, will there be any innocence left to safeguard and base Dothrak? Or will any innocents shake with fear and bow their heads in submission to Daenerys? These potential shifts are subtle, but they're of great importance. A current running through these potential future events is that of Dany's new status as a villain. But is she actually a villain? In an interview with Charlie Jane Anders of IO9, George R. R. Martin gave a very thoughtful response to the question of evil. When I'm writing in the viewpoint of one of the characters, I'm really inside their skin. So you trying to get the sense of the world through their eyes is to understand why they do the things that they do. And we all have, even the characters who are thought to be bad guys, who are actually bad guys in some objective sense, don't think of themselves as bad guys. That's kind of the comic book kind of thing, where the Red Skull gets in the morning and asks, "What evil can I do today?" Real people don't think that way. We all think we're heroes. We all think we're good guys. We have our rationalizations when we do bad things. "Well, I had no choice," or "It's the best of several bad alternatives," or "No, it was actually good because God told me," or "I had to do it for my family." We all have these rationalizations for why we do shitty things, or selfish things, or cruel things. So when I'm writing from the viewpoint of one of the characters who has done these things, I try to have that in my head. Unquote. Dany's future turn as a villain will not be one where she'll contemplate what evil she can do. Almost assuredly, Daenerys will continue to view herself as the hero in her own story. But to the reader, Dany's turn to villainy will be one where Dany rationalizes her moral compromises away from a perspective of, quote, fulfilling destiny. The Dothraki may be a people whose warlike enslaving ways warrant some kind of cosmic justice in the form of dragonfire. But will Dany's actions be done from a perspective of justice divorced from human emotion? Or will they be tied intrinsically to her new prophetic Mother of Dragons desire to exact vengeance on those who have wronged her? It's my estimation that Dany's rebirth into fire and blood will continue into the Dothraki Sea. So, if Dany can secure a great Khalasar and base Dothrak and eliminate Khal Jaqo and Mago, her power will be great and terrible indeed, but it will only be phase one of her Winds of Winter arc. Phase two can only take her to one place, to the city that is not her home, to the people she rejected as her children, to a war she fought so hard to forestall, and to a fiery god that will give her new purpose and destiny. Dany is coming back to Meereen. So that concludes part two of The Dragon's Mercy, The Violent Future Path of Daenerys Targaryen. I want to thank everybody for listening today. This was a lot of fun to write as an essay, and it was a lot of fun to record, too. There's obviously so much to write about Dany, and there's so much that I probably missed, and I would love if you guys would let me know in the comments of my blog or on Podbean or on iTunes to see if there's things that I missed out in the arc or places where you think that she's going to go. And, you know, I really enjoy discussion and debate. And if you think I'm wrong in any of the points that I made here, just let me know in a comment or let me know in an email or on Twitter or on Facebook. I would be happy to discuss anything that you'd like to with you all. One last thing before I go. The music that you heard at the very beginning is done by a very good friend of mine named Matthew Loftus. He's a great guy. He's an amazing person and an example to me and someone that I love a whole lot. and I'm very pleased to call him my friend. We're in a band together known as the Pressman Preachers, and that song is a song of his called Jaded, and we'll actually be doing some recording at the end of December. Yeah, on New Year's Eve, we'll be doing a recording at his house where we'll record a full-out band version of that song. So maybe in a future podcast, I'll be able to share with you guys the full-out band recording of Jaded by the Pressman Preachers. So that's it. Thank you guys very much for listening. I'm not sure when the next recording will come out necessarily, but I've been talking with Militant Penguin and Something Like a Lawyer, two guys who work with me on the blog, about having a podcast that's going to be more of an interactional one, where there'll be three hosts, the three of us, talking about topics or subjects in the Song of Ice and Fire world. And our tentative first podcast, we're calling I Come Not to Praise Rhaegar Targaryen. So I hope you stick around, subscribe on iTunes to see when that will come out, or maybe the next recording for the Dragon's Mercy Part 3 will come out first. Anyways, thanks again very much for listening, and take care.